Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we've got a double kind of topic episode for you tonight. We're going to be doing some updates and follow-up from a previous call. And well, before we get into that, though, we've got to bring Sam Bradley in here, who is out in Colorado and just kind of chilling in the midst of everything that's going on.
Yeah, sometimes California feels like a good place to be. Like we're kind of nestled in here in the Rockies and, you know, all the bad things can't find us. I like to look at it that way. Certainly no tornadoes, at least at the moment. But Kyle Nelson, meteorologist, ski patroller, 911 dispatcher, I hear there's some weather coming in toward the southeast this week.
Yes, Sam. Good evening to everyone on the Disaster Podcast. The southeast is under the gun yet again this week here. So looking at March 9th and 10th, as well as the 11th as well, there's going to be a definite threat of severe weather across the southeast, largely from the kind of Ozarks Plateau on through central Tennessee and the northern parts of Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. But so just stay alert for that. Otherwise, looks to be high and dry in the western U.S.
Cool. Well, maybe we can escape any more disaster than we already have this week, which we want to talk about because Joe Holly and Kimberly Holly were recently in Nashville. So we want to talk about that and talk about, you know, you followed us along as Kimberly started, you know, training USAR dogs and everything she's learned. And I guess you get a bit of a trial by fire in Nashville. But Joe, this coronavirus thing, as much as I think people are kind of out there in terms of, you know, the panic and, oh, we're all going to die, and the preppers laughing because they have stuff and they have toilet paper and nobody else does. But this morning I hear the whole country of Italy shut down. I mean, it is getting kind of serious. Can you give us some updates on it?
Sure. I think you're right. There's a lot of hype, and it is difficult to sort through the newsgasm sometimes related to coronavirus. Related to Italy, yes, they have sort of kind of locked the entire country down from a quarantine standpoint. In reality, the intensive care docs there are basically saying they're having a tsunami on their ICU bed availability, and that the intensive care services are completely overwhelmed with a large number of patients requiring intensive care. So while I think the quarantine idea from a containment standpoint is sort of a questionable actual benefit, they truly are beginning to see a very large number of fairly sick patients from this. They are definitely experiencing quite a bit of pretty substantial demand on the healthcare system for what sound like a pretty large number of sick patients.
Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to ask, you know, just to clarify, I mean, some of these things like the social distancing, the closing of large scale events and sporting event spectator crowds or whatever they're looking at doing, and especially what happens in Italy, isn't that more not to like keep people from getting the virus ever, but to slow the spread to try to stay ahead of that ICU curve?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jamie. It currently looks like in the U.S. the doubling rate number, that is the number of days it takes to double the number of cases in the community, is currently at about 6 days. And obviously anything that can be done to slow that down means that surge of demand for emergency and intensive care services gets spread out over a longer period of time, and therefore allows us better use of our current capacity. So those are very legit issues there. You know, I think if we look at it in terms of trying to stop the spread of virus, we're not likely to have much success there. But if we do look at it in terms of aggressive efforts to slow the spread, there is great benefit to the healthcare system to do that.
Well, Joe, it's true that all areas now are able to test for that specific virus.
Yes, although testing still seems to be quite limited in many states, that still requires the sample being transported to a state health department lab, which may be several hours away. The turnaround time once it arrives in the lab seems to be about 24 hours. There are commercial testing products that are beginning to come online, and I think we'll probably begin to see much more routinely in the next week or so. What that basically means is that testing is still fairly limited and has been limited to patients who are pretty symptomatic. The challenge there, of course, is that we may have a much larger number of patients who are not terribly symptomatic, and that's good for those patients, but it's bad from a potential spread of the virus around if those minimally symptomatic patients are out in public, going to work, et cetera, and potentially spreading the virus around without even realizing they are doing so.
Well, we have an entire podcast about the worried well coming up from a psychological standpoint and a clinical standpoint. But Joe, just in a nutshell, what advice do you have for the worried well? Because I think that people that listen to us kind of depend on the truth instead of hearing all the hype out there. So if it comes from you, I think people will trust it.
Well, that's good to hear. I try to pass on information that comes from guys on the front line that I have great faith and trust in, and I'm sure are telling me straight. We're a group that tends to share our collective experiences with very little political concern. So thank you for that. I think there's no question that social distancing has value. It appears very clear from some of the early high caseload areas, primarily Washington State, et cetera, that there is a exposure dose relationship. So patients who are not terribly symptomatic, meaning not producing a lot of droplets by coughing or sneezing, are much less likely to pass on the virus than those that are producing lots of that stuff. Distance seems to make a difference. Shielding to some extent, meaning PPE, face mask, et cetera, also are beneficial there. So it has been very consistent that the virus appears to be droplet spread, not aerosol or airborne spread. So meaning you can't just breathe out the virus and somebody catch it. It has to be on a droplet of sputum or spittle or whatever. So it requires coughing and that sort of stuff and the droplet to get on you to be able to pass the virus. So anything that we can do to keep ourselves out of those situations is beneficial. We have been discussing approaches to patients who have significant respiratory symptomatology and how we might need to alter our practices to care for them being cautious in how we use nebulized medication so that we don't create a lot of droplets flying around in the back of an ambulance. Obviously the PPE related stuff. So the PPE currently seems quite effective when it's used properly. An N95 mask and goggles and gloves and a gown. That seems to be extremely effective at preventing spread of the virus. So I would certainly encourage people to use their PPE like they're supposed to.
Well, I'm sure the first responders will feel a little bit better about that. But one more question. How does that first guy, that ground zero patient zero, get it? How does it get to him So then he that can then affect others. I mean, I've always been curious about that.
Yeah, I think that is a great question and one that we do not have an answer to. There is a positive high school patient in King County, Washington, that was picked up on a community flu screening process, who was completely asymptomatic and had no risk factors, travel experience, or exposure. And yet he was positive for the virus. So we do not know clearly how he got that and how it is being, transmitted around to others very clearly. Obviously, the patient that he was exposed to must have been minimally symptomatic and had close enough contact to allow some sort of spread.
Well, I guess we can quit beating up the Chinese then, because those poor people are taking a rap. So, Mr. Kyle, any thoughts on this topic before we move on?
Well, Sam, I think it's important for providers, not just themselves, to be informed, but to share good information with and official information with their family members and their friends as well, so that we can work together to combat the misinformation and disinformation that's being put out there. And as Joe said, to help reduce some of that hype and things that people may read, and directing folks to those official sources and like the Center for Disease Control, your state and local health departments, who are working around the clock overtime and then some to keep communities safe, keep them informed, and heed their recommendations and their advice.
Very good, because people get the real advice. Don't go with what you hear on social media, because those are a bunch of panic people too. So get the real word. Jamie?
Just a quick question, Kyle. Are you getting any different direction as far as handling a call a call coming in for a respiratory problem? Is there any specific wording you're using regarding coronavirus questions during the dispatch process?
Jamie, that's an excellent question. One of the software tools that we use at Dispatch is a program called ProQA, and that is a digital version of a card set that's used that we use to help provide some pre-hospital questioning and pre-hospital and pre-arrival instructions for people who are experiencing either a trauma or a medical emergency. Because of the recent uptick in and the attention around coronavirus, we have actually begun doing some additional questioning of people that call in with certain chief complaints. And that way we can help to sort of pre-screen them over the phone before our responders arrive, so that we can give them a heads up so they can keep themselves safe as well.
Good to know. And I'm sure the providers appreciate that too. So we'll switch from one disaster to another here. Those of you that caught the little update we did last week heard Dr. Joe talking about being en route to Nashville behind his wife, Kimberly, and their dog people and her dogs. This was a state deployment, not a federal deployment, as you're used to hearing us talk about. So, Joe, jump in and tell us what happened when you got there, because that's where we left off.
Sure. So we actually, both the dog teams and myself in kind of my state role, went to Cookeville, Tennessee, which is about 45 or 50 miles east of Nashville. There were several neighborhoods in the Nashville area that were hit with, I believe, two or four fatalities. I'm not 100% certain on the numbers there. And then some damage to property along Interstate 40 between there and Cookeville. But Cookeville seemed to be the community that was most hardest hit. There were one neighborhood that was effectively completely destroyed and another close by that was severely damaged, ultimately with about 80-plus injuries there and 18 fatalities. So we spent a day there engaged with the local and regional responders in the area doing search and rescue work. That wrapped up fairly quickly thanks to a pretty aggressive response and a fair number of regional responders who could get there quickly in a relatively confined space that required search.
Well, this was a perfect situation for the USAR dog team. And, where we left off the last time we talked with any length of time with Kimberly, she was still training herself and her dogs. And since then, she's most recently especially had some local responses. So I'd like to hear about that and then what her experience was with the dogs in Cookeville.
Well, sure. So hi, everyone. The morning following the tornadoes was very interesting because we had already committed some, our team had already committed some canine resources for a local missing person search. And so I was one of them. And we felt it was very important to be there for those local teams that needed assistance. So honestly, as we were gathering our resources as the larger team on who could deploy to Cookeville, whose dogs were healthy, which is always the most important thing, which of our handlers were healthy and could travel and could be there, I was already en route to a local response for a missing persons. And as that was wrapping up, which was a successful find, we got the call that we needed to deploy to Cookeville. And so it was a rush home from one site that was about an hour away from home, turn around, grab the other dog, load up everything, have all my gear, all my safety equipment, and then back on the road with members of my team to Cookeville. So it was, of course, all deployments can be rushed in their own way, but that one certainly was, as we were already committed to, helping out elsewhere in the meantime.
So, well, Joe knows all about that.
I'm sorry?
Joe knows all about that. I think back to 2007 where we had one hurricane after another. But, while I'm interrupting you here, tell us a bit about your dogs.
Well, so I have two dogs that I train and work with that are both certified search dogs. I have Issa, who is a two-year-old Belgian Malinois. She is my live find search dog. She currently has about 15 stitches in her leg because that is the life of a Belgian Malinois. And things like barbed wire fences and teeth don't seem to bother her, so she just moves right through them. So we spend a lot of time at the vet's office with her, but she is a brilliant search dog, and I have it has been quite an honor to work with her and train her since she came to our family. Our other search dog is Ed. Ed is a 4.5-year-old black Labrador, and he is a human remains detection canine. Ed and I certified in October. I had not had him long. He had been living probably very happily on a couch, but we knew that there was more for him. So I got him through the team and started working with him, and he really loves his work. He loves his couch time. Don't get me wrong. He is a Labrador, but he does love his work, and he's gotten, I will say Ed and I have gotten baptism by fire, if you will, over the last few weeks. From the minute we got certified, we've been on some searches and we've kept ourselves busy.
Well, he's going to be one of those kind of dogs. So isn't there a story behind how Ed got his name?
Well, so, yeah, Ed, we try to, a lot of times on our team, we'll name dogs after former members of the team, retired members of the team. Also, sometimes we'll name dogs after fallen firefighters and task force members. Ed was named after one of the original canine handlers on the team who really helped build the canine part of Tennessee Task Force One. And his dog, Gus, was one of the most, I think one of the most widely photographed canine at 9/11. So, so Ed is named after, a man named Ed, who, really kind of paved the way for all of us on this team, at least.
Wow. That's good. That's good to know. So do the dogs get really excited? Say you're rolling into Cookeville now. Do they know they're in a disaster area and there's work to be done?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting about the work that we do is we train all the time, but of course, and we have Rubble. We have a fantastic training facility and that we have access to, that we work the dogs. I work him at home on drills and tightening up his skills. There, we have wide area search resources where we can work with him. But the work that you do in training is very pristine, and we can really sort of choreograph what the dogs are doing. We know where the sources are that we're training with, our training aides. When you walk into a disaster, which was, you know, obviously Cookeville was my first disaster, we don't know what we're looking for. We don't know if there are victims, where they might be. And the dog is amazing. They truly treat it as every other training session that we've had leading up. He did not scare away there, you know, in this particular situation. Of course, there are huge backhoes and tractors, and they're pulling houses apart and they're delayering rubble. And there are hundreds of responders in any one area looking, and the dogs performed beautifully. I have to say, they didn't seem phased in any way, shape, or form by it. The only challenge for Ed is when I would call him to me, and he had beautiful recall, was just figuring who I was among the 100 other people that were standing around. But, while the training can never really duplicate what the disaster scenario is going to be, I can see where everything that we do leads to so much confidence in your dog when you're in the field.
Well, that's a lot of stimulus. Jamie, you had a question?
Yeah, Kimberly, just a question. This is, I guess, is more of a question about training, but I know with our dogs, they react very much to the mood, the attitude of the members of our family. If somebody's excited, they're excited. If somebody's down in the dumps, the dogs seem to sense all that. How much of your training involves making sure you have the right frame of mind to make sure that the dogs are reacting to you properly?
Well, I think that's very interesting. The first thing I would say is you're absolutely right. Dogs, whether they're pets or they're working dogs, absolutely do respond to the emotions of their handlers. When I tested ESA for our certification, I can tell you I was absolutely terrified. I've probably never been that nervous about anything I've ever done. And she woke up that morning and she was completely nervous. She was not at all herself. I think she, when we first started on the piles and we first started on our test, she absolutely read my nervousness and my apprehension. And once she started making her finds, I calmed down, and then she worked beautifully the rest of the way through the test. And so that is absolutely yes, to answer your question, I do believe that the dogs feel our emotions, our stress, our anxiety, all of that. Again, I would say that I don't think there's anything that we can do in training that can really prepare us for, at least for me, walking out in that disaster scenario for the very first time. But I do have amazing team members who are extremely supportive and did not throw me to the wolves, if you will. They really helped me through that scenario and told me what I'd be doing and how I'd be doing it. Of course, I had a 4-hour ride on the way there to talk through all of that. So once our boots were on the ground, I did feel very confident. And again, I think it's all about trusting your dog. That is something that us canine folks, that's the mantra that we repeat a lot, but we do trust our dogs. And even if we're sort of a mess, the dogs know what they're doing.
So did Issa and Ed have any particular experiences?
Well, so we did bring Issa. Again, she's our live fine dog. Issa never got out of the vehicle, which is an unfortunate comment about the level of destruction that this tornado actually caused. Once we got there, it was very clear that human remains detection was what was required of this event. And so Issa spent the entire event in the vehicle. Ed was the one who worked, along with a few of our other canines on the team. So, you know, he really rose to the occasion. I can say that he worked very hard. He made an alert on something that, in hindsight, made a lot of sense to me that he would alert on. And all of the dogs, I think, worked beautifully in the situation that they were given.
So how many dogs did you travel in with, and how many teammates?
So there were three of us handlers total, and we had three human remains dogs, and then Issa was our live find, who never got out of the car.
Poor baby. Well, yeah. She'll All right. have her chance, hopefully on something local coming up, because that tends to be more what you have, or missing people and so forth, I assume.
Well, we've done a few of those lately, which has been fascinating for me, and those have been my first call out, my first local call outs. Ed has been my partner in those as well. And it's amazing the lessons that we have learned in just our short time as being a canine and handler team. And of course, I've learned an amazing amount from my team members and just from these different scenarios that we've done. I can't imagine that you ever walk away from any of these searches or disasters and not having just learned an entirely new skill set by the time you've left.
Well, that was actually my next question. What did you learn, and you know, what do you feel was good about the experiences the dogs had?
Well, for Cookeville specifically, I can tell you that working with the local responders and knowing or having some idea of what we were looking for, what or who we were looking for, was extremely important. Because, again, when we train, we have a somewhat controlled environment. Even though we want it to look like a disaster, it actually isn't. We don't do anything in training that would risk our canines or hurt them in any way. When you are out on a deployment, all of that goes out the window. There is glass, there is metal, there are things that are real hazards for the dogs. And so we do not want to run the dogs if there is a chance that they can get hurt just for the sake of running them. We really want to have the intel of what we're going to do and what is needed. We are never going to leave a scene if we think that there is a chance that we could help find someone. But at the same time, if we're just searching for the sake of, well, just search this area and make sure there's no one there, we want to be very cautious to run our dogs, because they are a vitally important tool in the search process, and we don't want to put them in a situation where they're going to get hurt in any way if we don't have good intel that there may be someone or something that we're looking for.
Well, thank you for taking us on this adventure with you from the very early stages. And Joe, I know you're proud of her.
Absolutely. She's the bomb.
I'd like to mention that Joe brought home a new truck today, And we have an agreement in our family that whenever Joe gets a new car, Kimberly gets a new puppy. So I really think everyone involved in the Disaster Podcast should stay tuned, because I feel like that's probably going to happen sometime soon.
Oh, I can't wait.
I'm probably going to return the truck.
He used to tell us that every time he came back from an employment, there was a deployment, there was a new animal. But this time you have an upfront agreement.
Keep standing up for me. I'm catching up. That's what's happening.
Oh, okay. I can't wait to hear about the new puppy. So, Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you. I think we run enough of their time out. They're still getting all kinds of communication coming in. So we'll let them go back to that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that I've kept hearing over and over again from Kimberly's experience was the value that she had in training the way she planned on responding with the dogs. And I think that this is something that's key. We talk about this all the time on the show. It's one of the things that always brings us back to Paragon Medical Education Group and the work, Joe, that you do with your team there. I know Kimberly's part of that team as well. To make sure that the best possible experiential training is provided so people can train on live tissue, so they can better react when they have live tissue in the field during an actual event. Where can folks find Paragon Medical Education Group, and where can they reach out to you to get that that ball rolling in trying to find out how you can customize something specifically for them?
Well, we would certainly love to talk to people. You know, not only do we want our training to be realistic, but we want the educators to be experienced and in the field. And so it's important for us to be out there doing the latest stuff so that we can carry that through to the folks that we're working with educationally. Nevertheless, we would certainly love to talk to anybody that has any interest. They can reach us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. There's a contact us there on the website. They can reach us through our Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group, on Facebook, or always through the Disaster Podcast.
And thank you again, Joe. Kimberly, I know you're active with, the Search and Rescue Dog Foundation, I believe. Where can that be found? And, you know, so folks can find out how they can support what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you for bringing up. It's the USAR Foundation, and it is the nonprofit that helps support what we do and helps us provide training for ourselves and our canines and gear and safety equipment and all that good stuff. And you can find that online on Facebook, on Instagram at usarfoundation.org.
Awesome. Thanks again for taking the time tonight, Kimberly. Really appreciate it. Sam, where can folks find you?
Looking for the mute button, usually. What Joe mentioned, the social media arena under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, disasterpodcast.com, or certainly our Facebook group, conveniently on Facebook. What about you, Jamie?
I can be located under the handle PodMedic in most social media circles out there, so please look me up, friend, or follow me there. Of course, disasterpodcast.com, where if you haven't noticed already, right below the audio player at the top of the page and in the sidebar on disasterpodcast.com, there are links to subscribe to the show, so you can find get an episode update whenever one comes in, either using your favorite podcasting app on iOS or Android, or as an email update if you want as well. So please take advantage of that. Sam, this has been a great episode. I'm glad we took the time to catch up with both Joe and Kimberly following this particular event in and around the Nashville area. It's important to learn from these live and recent events because this is not going to be the only tornado that strikes anywhere in the country over the coming months as we come into that more active weather cycle.
Exactly, and I appreciate the fact that Dr. Joe has given us the straight scoop on coronavirus out there, and we'll continue to do that as long as this is an issue. But in this case, I think we can say that USAR dogs are not our everyday dogs.